From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Michael Eisner, CEO of the Walt Disney Company. He's led the company through a period of extraordinary growth. In addition to theme parks, TV shows, and its film studio, Disney owns several cable networks, ABC TV, retail stores, sports franchises, newspapers, radio and TV stations, and a book publishing company. Eisner has written a new memoir called Work in Progress. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel, Reservation Road, and Lloyd Schwartz tells us about the new Monet Blockbuster Museum show. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Yasser Arafat says he has accepted the proposal for Israel to hand over another 13% of the West Bank. That's as a key point of a Middle East peace agreement. Arafat made the announcement after meeting with President Clinton today at the White House. 3% of the area would become a nature preserve between the Israelis and Palestinians, effectively serving as a security buffer. This follows the agreement between Arafat and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to meet again in Washington next month to try and shore up a long-sought-after Middle East peace deal. In Malaysia, ousted Deputy Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim pleaded not guilty to corruption and sodomy charges brought by the government. NPR's Michael Sullivan reports from Kuala Lumpur.
Anwar's court appearance today was the first time he'd been seen in public since his detention 9 days ago, and he entered the courtroom sporting a large bruise over his left eye and rolled up his sleeve to show more. Wire services quote Anwar as saying he was badly beaten the night police came for him, and he's lodged a formal complaint with the police about his injuries. Anwar pleaded not guilty to all of the counts against him. He faces a maximum penalty of 20 years in jail if convicted on the corruption charges and a maximum of 20 years on the sodomy charges as well. Anwar claims he is the victim of a political conspiracy, an attempt to end his political career to prevent him from exposing what he says is high-level corruption and cronyism in Prime Minister Mahathir's government. Michael Sullivan, NPR News, Kuala Lumpur.
The Senate today passed a measure to increase financial aid to college students while cutting the interest rates on student loans. It now awaits the president's signature. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Much of the president's education agenda is stuck in the Republican-led Congress. Plans to greatly increase school construction and hire 100,000 new public school teachers remain unfunded. What Congress could agree on is a modest reduction in interest rates for student loans. Connecticut Democrat Christopher Dodd said the 1% cut will make a difference.
Students in my state could save as much as $650 a year. Now, that may not seem like a lot to some, but to middle-income families in my state, that kind of a savings can make a huge, huge difference.
The measure also boosts the maximum amount for a Pell Grant and forgives the loans of students who teach in urban or rural school districts for 5 years. A Senate amendment to include education in the approved list of welfare-to-work programs was dropped in conference committee. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, the Capitol.
What was once Hurricane George is now a tropical depression, but the remnants are flooding houses, businesses, and roads from Florida to Louisiana. In Pascagoula, Mississippi, the county administrator says he's never seen anything like it, floodwaters reaching rooftops and oyster shells in front yards. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up nearly 22 points at 8130.72. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, financial markets, including Wall Street, are watching Washington today. That's as members of the Federal Reserve Board's powerful Open Market Committee meet behind closed doors. NPR's Jack Speer reports.
Most analysts are betting when the smoke clears, the Federal Reserve Board will decide to cut interest rates at its meeting today. They say recent remarks by Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan plus market expectations make some kind of action on rates by the body almost a foregone conclusion. Mark Vintner is vice president of capital markets with Charlotte-based First Union. He says lack of action by the Fed would almost be too catastrophic for the markets to contemplate.
I think that it would be a major surprise, and the markets would react very negatively if the Fed did not cut rates today.
Last time the Fed moved on rates was March of 1997. Analysts expect at least a quarter of a point cut in the federal funds rate today. That is the rate banks charge one another for overnight loans. Meanwhile, the nonprofit business group, the Conference Board, announced today its September confidence index fell 7.1 points, its biggest monthly drop since January. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
The Supreme Court says it will hear an appeal by two large pension funds that opposed an $8 million settlement reached by agribusiness giant Archer Daniels Midland Company. It stems from shareholder lawsuits tied to a price-fixing case. The maker of Spam says it's buying back up to 5 million shares of its stock. Hormel says it will repurchase the shares over time at market prices. Levi Strauss says it's closing four factories in France and Belgium. Job losses could total more than 1,500, or about 20% of Levi's European workforce. I'm Dave Mattingly, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, a place to satisfy existing curiosities and discover new ones. Location information at 800-644-7733.
Support for NPR comes from The Imposters, the new comedy from Stanley Tucci, one of the creators of Big Night. Opens nationally October 2nd.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Michael Eisner, is the CEO of one of the most powerful entertainment companies in the world, the Walt Disney Company. He's also the former head of primetime programming at ABC TV and president of Paramount Pictures. He's written a new memoir called Work in Progress. Since Michael Eisner became the head of Disney in 1984, he's led the company through a period of enormous growth. 60% of the company's revenues come from businesses that were started or acquired under Eisner's leadership. Now the Disney company includes theme parks, retail stores, Walt Disney Pictures, Touchstone, Miramax, and Hollywood Pictures, ABC TV, ESPN, the Disney Channel, as well as the Arts and Entertainment, History, and Lifetime cable channels, the Regis and Kathy Lee Show, Monday Night Football, 9 TV stations, about 20 radio stations, several daily newspapers, home videos, stage plays like The Lion King, the new Amsterdam Theater in Times Square, the Hyperion Publishing Company, computer software, hotels, shopping centers, and the Internet Gateway Company, InfoSeek. I asked Michael Eisner if he thinks there might ever be a time when he'd say, okay, that's big enough, we don't need to grow anymore.
I said that in 1985. I was always very happy with the little company that we had making movies and television shows and animation. But you tend to grow by simply doing good products, and our animated movies help grow our company by synergizing our consumer products. There came a time that to be able to get our products to the marketplace, to be able to make them available, it became necessary to have a distribution company, and that's when we bought ABC. Large is not always good. Being the largest is certainly not always the best. We want to stay a family company. We act like a family company. Sometimes that gets us in trouble, and sometimes that enhances us.
We have, well over 100,000 employees.
We do. We have, I think, 130,000 to 150,000, depending on how you count people that we have partnerships with and those kinds of things. We had in the 20 to 30,000 number when I came to the company. So I am proud of the fact that we are employment for a lot of people, and by and large, our cast members, as we call them, really enjoy their work.
So what are some more of the advantages and disadvantages of being as big as Disney is? Well, advantages, obviously, is that there's more opportunities to make money, there's more opportunities to market and sell the products. Are there disadvantages to being that size?
Well, more of the advantages are the synergy between products. If you make a movie like, use The Lion King or Beauty and the Beast or Mulan or Little Mermaid or whatever, it then becomes apparent that you can make books based on the movie, you can make consumer products based on the movie, you can add attractions that are in your theme parks based on the movie. One thing leads to another, and they all interconnect, and that is our strength, and that is the strength of the Disney brand. When you have a radio network and you can create, like, Radio Disney. It's the natural evolution of having a radio network and having a Disney brand. So a lot of the growth and a lot of the size is kind of natural, obvious, common sense growth. It is harder to manage. It is harder to protect the brand when you're that large. But if you're not that large, you run the risk of being the skinny kid at the beach with the macho lifeguard kicking sand in your face. I mean, people from all over the world are competing. It's a very democratic, competitive system. And there are these other giant companies like News Corp and Time Warner and Bertelsmann and EMI and Universal. There are other companies. And when you get the Microsofts involved in your business, which they now are, or you get AT&T, which has just bought TCI, the big cable company, you will lose access. Your products will never see the light of day unless you are competitively strong.
So what you're describing sounds like a vicious cycle. As companies get bigger, companies have to get bigger, which means companies have to get bigger.
Well, 90% of the American competitive system is great, and it is what the free enterprise system is about, and it's what creates the largesse in our society, and what creates the growth in the company, and ultimately creates employment. The part that's not good is the obsession with quarter-to-quarter earnings and the obsession of being a growth company and the obsession of wealth. That creates greed and envy and all the kinds of things that are human and Shakespearean and you'd like to avoid. But in the end, if you have to weigh the two, the American system, the free enterprise system, is the root of our economic prosperity, and therefore I do stand behind it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Eisner, CEO of Disney, and author of a new memoir called Work in Progress. I grew up during the Mouseketeer era, and I know when I was growing up, the Disney name meant the Mickey Mouse Club and Disneyland and Cinderella and Sleeping Beauty and Pinocchio and stuff like that. Now that Disney is so large and into so many areas, I wonder what the brand means. For example, Disney owns Miramax now, which means that Pulp Fiction is in some ways a Disney film. So, you know, thus really changing the nature of what a Disney film would be. So what does the brand mean now?
No, the Disney brand means exactly what it meant to you when you were watching the Mickey Mouse Club. The Disney brand means what you said, and it now means Beauty and the Beast and The Lion King and Disney's Animal Kingdom and Epcot Center and Tokyo Disneyland and Disney Radio and Disney Channel and Disney
Pulp
products.
And
no, it does not mean Pulp Fiction, because 99% of the audience does not know that Miramax or Hollywood Pictures or Hollywood Records is part of the Walt Disney Company.
Use the Disney name on things that you want to have that kind of family connection with?
The Disney brand is a brand that means it's appropriate for the whole family. If you go with your 5 or 6 or 7 year old child to something branded Disney, you can feel comfortable that it's appropriate. Other non-Disney branded products that we have do not necessarily mean that they are gratuitously violent or sexual or inappropriate. They just mean they're not all family brands. ABC News is not Disney brand. It's not an all family brand. A lot of the things on the ABC television network are totally proper and tasteful, but they're not appropriate necessarily for young children. So the concept of being in these other brands, Miramax and so forth, is extremely important to maintain the Disney brand. For instance, when Walt Disney died, he was the talent. And from the time he died to the time I came in the company was still looking to do Disney-branded programming, but they didn't have anybody to do it. When I came in the company, one of the things we did was expand from just Disney to Touchstone and Hollywood and so forth, with the intent of doing movies that, one, made the company relevant, which I talk about a lot in my book. Two, by having directors and producers that were working on non-Disney material, we got to know them. Most of them have children, families of their own, and those that don't came from families. And eventually, the Bette Midlers and the Robin Williams and the Richard Dreyfuss and all the directors and the producers that were doing non-Disney movies came over and did Disney-branded material. And that's how we got Steven Spielberg to do Roger Rabbit. And that's how we got this one and that one to do Disney products.
Well, continuing with Miramax, what were the advantages for Disney and the advantages for Miramax when Disney bought Miramax in 1993? You describe it as the smartest move that Disney made in the movie business during that period. So what were the advantages on both sides?
Well, the advantage, the non-financial advantage on our side, is that Miramax was dealing with a coterie of very young, talented writers and directors, many of whom we have since brought in and used in not only television, but in Disney-branded family entertainment. The other advantage for Disney was in the financial area. We were buying a company that was making movies at a very reasonable price, and we were able to put them into the Disney machine of marketing, international distribution, home video, and the rest. So it was really a win-win, getting talent for Disney and a smart financial move by getting an additional kind of product that when you put it together with the Touchstone movies and the Disney movies, we became a major seller and competitor all around the world with our product.
My guest is Michael Eisner, CEO of the Walt Disney Company. He's written a new memoir called Work in Progress. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Michael Eisner is my guest, the CEO of Disney and author of a new memoir called Work in Progress. You write a little bit about Euro Disney, which opened in 1992, and the problems that Disney had there. And Euro Disney had the Magic Kingdom, six hotels, Disney Village, Davy Crockett campsites, and a golf course. What were the problems you had in the beginning with Euro Disney? What do you think you miscalculated in retrospect?
Well, we started building it.
Let me stop you here. We're going to be hearing a little bit of hammering, and it's not a theme park that's being built. I think it's the office building next door to the studio, and it's apparently very little we can do about it. So,
The question was about Euro Disney, and the answer about its positives and negatives are somewhat simple. We designed it and we built it during a boom period. We opened it during a recession, so that doesn't help to begin with. We, like anything in France, we're a stranger and an outsider, and even though it is maybe our best park and most beautiful thing built in France since, I don't know, I don't want to be too arrogant here, but I won't say the Louvre, but since the Tuileries or Bois de Boulogne, whatever, but we're an outsider. And the way the Eiffel Tower was an outsider and wasn't accepted for 50 years, so we were not accepted. And the president of France said it wasn't his cup of tea. Between the recession and not being his cup of tea and expensive, we built it. It cost a fortune to build, and we were asking too much per ticket, so that was not good either. We had a short-term problem. We solved the problem by cutting the costs, refinancing the park, and just living longer. And eventually, the word of mouth was fantastic. It always was a great park from day one. George Bush brought Mitterrand to the park for dinner. Mitterrand waved in front of the castle, and the rest was history. All the papers in France said, Euro Disney is France's. The fact of the matter is, so many of our stories come from French fairy tales that it wasn't hard to become a French park eventually.
You write in your memoir that there's no project during your first decade at Disney that you felt more passionate about than Disney's America, the history theme park. And there was no project that ran up against more resistance. Disney's America was a history theme park that was to be built about 5 miles from a real Civil War battlefield in Manassas, Virginia. And there were objections that the Disney version of history would offer a false or a sentimentalized version of history, and that it would detract from the importance and gravity of the real battlefield that was so close. Were you unprepared for the protests? Yeah, Disney lost on this one. That theme park was not built.
For the moment, we lost, and we lost because we handled the entrance and the public relations and how we dealt with it badly. It was not any of the things you described. It was not a sanitized version of history, a history that is unknown to the highest percentage of American kids ever, and a percentage that would just floor you as to how many kids don't know who our presidents were or what is the Declaration of Independence or what does it mean. They don't know who Thomas Paine is. They don't know who Franklin Roosevelt is. They maybe know who Jackie Kennedy was. They don't understand. American kids today, by and large, don't understand what is freedom and what is freedom of the press and what is basic human rights and things like that. So we were going to do a theme park, and still may do it. And some of the theme park you will find in Disney's California, near Anaheim when it's built, because we had so many ideas that I think are valid. And it was a great project. And as well as the project was designed, as good as it is, and how it showed a country that grew out of diversity and grew out of pluralism and what that means, and how well we did, is how badly we handled ourselves going to Washington. We had no idea, and it was silly, we should have known, we had no idea the fear of Mickey Mouse and history, what those two images in one's mind would connote. We had no idea, even though we were 5 miles away from a battlefield, which I inadvertently called the Battle of Bull Run, which is the northern version of it, not really realizing that Virginia was even in the south, and you call it the Battle of Manassas. I mean, those kinds of things was simply insensitivity to a region of the country that I wasn't aware was so sensitive. These mistakes buried it. These mistakes created a backlash and gave the landowners, who we were near, all the fodder that they needed to wage a effective lobby in a place where lobbying can be very effective against us. Yeah. And I got sick right in this period.
Right, you had bypass.
Right during this period. And when I got out of the hospital and I found out it was 6 weeks more, we'd have to be closed in the winter because it was colder there than we thought. And the economics started going south and politicians started going south and rich people started going south. I decided I better go south, and we put it on hold.
You know, something else you point out in your memoir is that the title Disney's America was maybe not the best choice of titles, because to some people it implied that Disney owned the country's history. And I guess that really gets to one of the biggest fears that people had, you know, that Disney's America would be like Disney rewriting history. So how do you address a concern like that?
I'm too close to the fire. I'm a moth too close to the flame. I love the words Disney's America. I think it describes exactly what it is. It's a park. It's a park that teaches history using Disney techniques. I think the Museum of Tolerance, or the Holocaust Museum more accurately in Washington, uses a lot of Disney technique. A lot of Disney people worked on that, all sorts of walkthroughs and use of multimedia effects. That's what I thought it meant. I didn't think it meant that Annette Funicello was going to be the Queen of America. But it was an unfortunate name in hindsight. I still think it sounds good, because when I heard it in our development meetings, Disney's America, well, that sounds perfect. That sounds what it should be. So when we developed the park in California to be next to Disneyland, and of course I would have immediately called it Disney's California, better minds prevailed, and we're now calling it Disney's California Adventure. Not a good name, Disney's California Adventure. Disney's California, to me, says this is the view of California by Disney.
Right.
I mean, it's no different than Morrison and Cominger's history of the United States. I mean, I don't think that sounds so bad. But the possessive Disney, which elicits a lot of Winnie the Pooh thoughts, didn't go well with the Annenbergs, let's say, and other people that lived close by.
I'd like you to address another concern about Disney, and this one is about theme parks. As you probably know, Carl Hiaasen, the Florida-based mystery writer, has written a short, very critical book about Disney, and there's a Disney world in his state that he is not very happy with, and he writes, "The absolute worst thing Disney did in Florida was to change how people in Florida thought about money. Nobody had ever dreamed there could be so much." And Hiaasen goes on to say that everybody became so obsessed with cashing in and catching the tourists after they departed to the kingdom that it just became, you know, this kind of commercial mess. So how do you react to that concern and that concern that people have, you know, where a theme park is being proposed?
Well, I think I haven't read Carl Hiaasen's book. He's a very good writer. I am told that this book is short and thin in almost every sense of the word. I think he's unrealistic about the world, and I think he frankly is misguided, and this was a job he could do to sell an essay. And I'd love to sit down and room with him, because I can't believe he believes some of the things I'm told he says. I think it's kind of silly. And I think you walk down Times Square today, as nice as it is, they're still selling little statues of the Empire State Building, and you're in Paris and they're selling T-shirts in Paris, and you're in Los Angeles and they're selling T-shirts, and the Hard Rock sells T-shirts, and everybody is merchandising everything. And I think that's kind of a sign of an affluent society, and I don't think it's particularly unattractive. And I know we don't do the kinds of things you just referred to, that trying to catch people as they walk outside of our park. And
no, he didn't say you did. He said that it just kind of creates this frenzy in which everybody else tries to cash in on what you're doing, thus changing the whole nature of the area around Disney World.
Well, it is possible that the area around Disney World was a very hot but nice ecological swamp where people hunted and hunted and camped and had a naturalist experience. Orlando is no longer a sleepy little town. There's no question about that. Disney came there, and Orlando is one of the big growing markets. It's an urban city, and I'm sure they have urban problems. And to that degree, if you live there and enjoyed the lakes and the swamps and the alligators, and there are less of them there now than there were, I guess maybe that would be something that you would be concerned with. But I don't think that relates to what we do.
Michael Eisner is the CEO of the Walt Disney Company. His new memoir is called Work in Progress. We'll talk more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Whistle while you work. Put on that grin and start right in to whistle loud and long. Just hum a merry tune. Just do your best and take a rest and sing yourself a song. When there's too much to do, don't let it bother you. Forget your troubles, try to be just like the cheerful chickadee, and whistle while you work. Come on, get smart and tune up and start to whistle while you wait. Forget your troubles, trying to be just like that cheerful chickadee, and whistle while you work. Come on, get smart. Tune up and start to whistle while you wave.
Coming up, more with Disney's CEO, Michael Eisner. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Reservation Road, and Lord Schwartz reviews the new blockbuster museum show, Monet in the 20th Century. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Michael Eisner, the CEO of the Walt Disney Company. He's written a new memoir called Work in Progress. When we left off, we were discussing criticisms of the Disney theme parks. Disney has also taken a lot of heat from cultural conservatives and members of the religious right. For example, when Ellen came out on her TV show on ABC, which is owned by Disney, Disney took heat. When Disney initiated an employee policy that offered health insurance to the partners of gay employees, Disney took a lot of heat. Did you have any concern, for instance, both of the things I just mentioned had to do with gay issues, did you have any concerns that this would violate the Disney family image? How did you deal with the anger that was directed at the company?
Honestly, I've always believed, and I may turn out to be disappointed, but right is right. And if you do what you think is correct and you're consistent and you don't waffle and you have a reasonable approach and you're not arbitrary, you will, in the end, be better off than trying to waffle and satisfy everybody on every situation. We felt that we are an inclusive company. We have a non-discriminating, a very strong non-discrimination policy. We felt that gay couples who demonstrate that they really are long-term partners have rights for insurance. They are not allowed under law to be married, and therefore we felt that we had, under certain conditions, the right and the obligation to treat them equally. Likewise, when Ellen DeGeneres came to us and said she wanted her show to reflect her own sexual proclivities and move the show in that direction because she thought it would be a better show, we did not disagree. And I think it would be inappropriate to disagree. That does not mean we have a homosexual agenda. That does not mean we are trying to foster anti-family behavior. That does not mean that we advocate or don't advocate homosexuality. We simply think we should be reasonable and fair and have common sense. That does not always go well with some very strongly conservative religious people, and they have the right to feel that way. I think I honor the fact they feel that way, but that doesn't mean that we should succumb and change our principles.
So how much of a hit did you take from the protests against Ellen or the protests against the health insurance for partners of gay employees?
We didn't take any hit because in the end, I think that the protesters were a very, very small minority of the population and a very, very small minority of even their own organization. I think in the end, in the quiet of people's homes, most people think fairness is correct. I think they don't know what's in store for them in the future. They don't know how everybody in their family lives and breathes. And I think they are fair. I think people generally are fair.
I want to quote something that Frank Rich, the New York Times columnist and former Times theater critic, said about Disney. He said, "Disney's implications for our culture, whether that culture be journalism, sports, movies, TV, radio, publishing, Broadway, cyberspace, zoos, urbanology, are far too vast and complex to be categorized simply as good or bad. It's the biggest ongoing cultural story of our time." That's a big statement. And I wonder if... What sense of responsibility you feel Disney should have in that sense, it being such a big cultural story, it owning so much of the means of production of American culture?
I think that, and I read Frank Rich every week. He has also said he thinks things like The Lion King are worthy or more appropriate. I think he thinks what we did at Times Square, I don't want to, is worthy. I can't really remember exactly his review on The Lion King. I don't agree with him because he exists. We will be slapped down by cultural critics, reporting critics, and certainly our competition as we get too big. You can't hoard culture. You can't hoard creativity. You can't have everybody. The day you think you have all the creativity, some person comes out of Indianapolis that you never heard of and become Steven Spielberg. There is no hoarding of culture and like grains of sand, we will come and go and times will change. For the moment, people seem to like Winnie the Pooh and Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck, but they also like Sesame Street and they also like Nickelodeon and they also like the Warner characters and they also like a lot of other things. And also America is not the biggest place in the world.
One of the fears, I think, for example, is, you know, that Disney has so much control over American culture in the sense that you can make the movies, make the videos of the movies, distribute the videos, sell the videos in the Disney stores, show the movies on ABC TV or the cable stations that you own. And that's just one example in the movie video industry. Do you know what I mean? But there are so many kind of interlocking things right now owned by Disney.
If you couldn't do that, you couldn't afford to make them in the first place. And America, which is right today, the biggest export of America is intellectual product, music, movies, television, bigger than the airline and aircraft industry. If you can't afford to do, and there's the knocking again, but if you can't afford...
Construction next door, nothing we can do, sorry.
Maybe it's one of our competitors making a show.
Or if one of our competitors.
If you can't afford to make the kind of high-end American movies that we now make, you will have to then be on the competitive basis of French and Italian and Indian film. And you will lose that edge of having this great export. So I believe that for the country to stay strong in intellectual product, you need companies the size of Time Warner and News Corp and Universal and others.
An example of a potential problem, when Disney bought ABC Television, ABC, of course, covers a lot of cultural news, and a lot of the culture it covers is produced by Disney. Now, I mean, there are excellent journalists at ABC, and I would never dream of questioning their integrity or their ability to do their jobs. But a lot of conflict of interest is just the perception of the possibility of conflict of interest, and there would surely be a perception that ABC journalists might have more difficulty freely covering, in a critical way, anything produced by Disney.
I would prefer ABC not to cover Disney-produced things. I think what you end up having more often than not is the father being the umpire with his kid at bat in Little League. The father is more apt to call his kid out than he is to walk him for fear that he would be considered to be biased. So for just the opposite reasons, I think it's not just the opposite. I think it's inappropriate for Disney to be covered by Disney. At the same time, I will say that Disney has, since 1985, owned the Siskel and Ebert show, and they review our movies in Chicago and have been since for 13 or 14 years. And there's not a week that goes by that I'm not aggravated with one of their reviews. They give us good reviews. They give us bad reviews. They give us the same percentage of good or bad reviews that we would have if we didn't own them. They just happen to be two highly ethical men. And there's that hammering again. But by and large, the way you avoid the conflict of interest is to, as best you can, not cover yourself and let others cover you.
Here's the thing. You say you think it's actually inappropriate for ABC to cover Disney. The other argument is that what's really inappropriate is for Disney to own ABC. ABC is a news organization, and they can't afford to have things off limits to coverage or things that would be inappropriate to cover.
There are plenty of news outlets today to cover Disneyland or to cover the making of A Bug's Life. There is, forgetting public radio, there are all news cable channels, whether it's CNN or MSNBC or CNBC or Fox. There are three other major television networks plus public. I don't think this country has a lack of reporters and investigators running around. If, in fact, it was the government, which we are not, if there was one television station owned by the government and that television station also owned a lot of the intellectual product, you would have a real point and a real problem. But that's not our system, thank God, and I don't think that is a problem at all.
So is that the policy, that ABC can't cover Disney?
We don't have a written policy about that. ABC News knows that I would prefer them not to cover it. They really knows, know I don't want any puff pieces. I don't want any executive profiles. I don't want any positive pieces on our company, because I think they run false, even if they are totally honest and clean. They know that. I am not on ABC facilities talking about my book. I went on Dateline, and I went on the Today Show. I did not go on 2020. I did not go on Good Morning America. I could have. Everybody would have wanted to talk about this book, I think. But I don't want the perception of impropriety, because in this day and age, perception and impropriety sometimes are too closely linked.
What about ABC remaining competitive, though? I mean, is that important to you? And to remain competitive in entertainment journalism, you have to cover the big movie of the week, or, you know, the big entertainment story of the week. What's out on video this week? And, Disney releases so much, to not be able to talk about that. How does that hobble a network?
ABC covers Good Morning America, I think, does review our movies, just like Siskel and Ebert review our movies. They make it clear that they're reviewing a movie by the company that owns both things. They're very clear about that. But by and large, it's not necessary. ABC News has a lot of things to cover. They do a very good job. I think 2020 and previously Primetime and Nightline and Good Morning America and Peter Jennings and Ted Koppel, they all cover the world. The world is more important, by the way, than Disney. They cover national events. They do an excellent job. They are the backbone of ABC. We also have, you know, NFL and NHL hockey and hopefully a growing and more prosperous schedule. We have our soap operas schedule, and which we own those soap operas. We don't review them that I know of with ABC News. But by the way, since television was created by the Radio Corporation of America, and David Sarnoff created it, and he made color television sets, and he made electronics, and General Electric now owns NBC. And Rupert Murdoch has certainly a lot of conflicting interests. And it's a complicated world, and you have to count on, to a degree, people's bright and good side and their healthy side and their ethical side. These last couple of weeks, we've been concentrating on people's dark side and unethical side and unhealthy side. But people are both, and there are a lot of people that understand this.
You grew up in a wealthy family, and you say you didn't really know the meaning of money when you were young, because when you were really young, you thought everybody lived like you do. Now you work with huge amounts of money as the CEO of Disney, and I mean, I think it was last year you exercised stock options that brought $565 million to you, so you work with really big money. Has the meaning of money changed to you since you work with so much now in your personal life and, of course, as the CEO of Disney?
Money has never been a driving force for me. I'm fairly uninterested in it. I have had it all my life, so it's not something that I learned to like. The money that I've made, I've either paid in taxes or more like 30 or 40% put away, given to a personal foundations and stuff like that. I like having the money. I can't say I don't like having the money. I don't ever think about it. I'm like a cobbler. I don't worry about it. Somebody else worries about it, and I'm much more interested in sitting in a room and hearing a good idea than sitting in a room and hearing about an investment opportunity. I'm not really a businessman in that sense. I'm pretty bad. I wouldn't put me in charge of some investment portfolio.
Michael Eisner. He's the CEO of the Walt Disney Company and author of the new memoir, Work in Progress. By the way, we called ABC TV's press relations department to clarify ABC's policy on covering Disney films, products, and related news stories, and we were told they cover Disney the same way they cover any other company. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel, Reservation Road. This is Fresh Air. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says it's understandable that some readers will want to detour around John Burnham Schwartz's new novel, Reservation Road, but they do so at the risk of missing an unsettling and ingeniously told story.
I described the plot of John Burnham Schwartz's Reservation Road to a few people I know, and they all scrunched up their faces, shook their heads, and said, in effect, "Not the book for me." All of those people had small children. You also might not want to read this novel if you're a worrier or afraid of the dark. I've got some aesthetic qualms, too, about wholeheartedly recommending Reservation Road to you. This is a novel that revels in the oppressive atmosphere and none too subtle conventions of film noir. For instance, in the first chapter, a family driving along a country road at night stops, by chance, at that most popular of noir locales, a desolate gas station. There, they happen to stumble smack in the way of fate. This setup is about as contrived as the famous opening scene of Orson Welles' noir classic, Touch of Evil, with its long camera shot. But despite the flamboyant silliness of Touch of Evil, it's hard to blink or breathe when watching that first scene unfold, and the same could be said of Reservation Road. Schwartz has something of Welles' audaciousness. Because he writes so powerfully, it doesn't really matter that the premise and some of the techniques of his novel are so hackneyed that there might as well be a red neon sign flashing the word doom above those gas pumps. From the first moments of this emotionally wise and suspenseful novel, Schwartz lures us readers into going along for the ride. Our main narrator here is named Ethan Lerner, and he's an English professor at a small New England college. "I want to tell this right," Ethan says. "I was 38 years old. I had spent my entire adult life reading meanings into other people's stories, finding the figure in the carpet, the order in things, God in the details, and no place else." What Ethan wants to tell right is the story of his son's death, which occurs at that ominous gas station. Wandering into the dark road while his parents and sister pile out of the car to wipe off the windshield and visit the restroom, 10-year-old Josh Lerner is killed by a speeding hit-and-run driver. That driver, named Dwight Arno, is also one of the novel's narrators, as well as an eerie double of Ethan. Dwight, too, is the father of a 10-year-old boy, but because of his erratic, sometimes violent temper, Dwight has alienated his son, who means everything to him. It's the thought of losing his son's respect forever that keeps Dwight's foot pressed hard to the pedal after the accident. There are heroes and there are the rest of us, he says. There comes a time when you just let go the ghost of the better person you might have been. In the ghastly months after the accident, Ethan distances himself from his wife, Grace, who's been zombified by her own overwhelming grief and further dehumanized into an object of pity by the gossips in their small town. Mild-mannered Ethan also grows more like Dwight as his frustration with the uninspired police investigation swells into rage. Elegantly, Schwartz bends the strands of Ethan's and Dwight's lives so that they intersect at key moments. If you were to diagram the twisting, crossing storylines of this novel, they would look like the Crick-Watson model of DNA. But as inventive as his plotting is, Schwartz's mastery as a writer really emerges in the way he orchestrates the separate dawning awarenesses on the part of Ethan and Dwight's son and his ex-wife that they might just know the identity of the hit-and-run driver. Again, that first teasingly slow scene of Touch of Evil comes back to mind. And like the noir, when the bombshell of epiphany explodes here, it's in part a trick of fate that decides who's left intact.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Reservation Road by John Burnham Schwartz. Coming up, Lord Schwartz reviews the new exhibition of Monet's late paintings. This is Fresh Air. The major blockbuster museum show this season is Monet in the 20th Century at the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. It's the largest exhibit ever assembled of Monet's late paintings done in the last 25 years of his life. The exhibit travels to London in December. Our classical music critic Lord Schwartz says he's lucky to live in the only American city where he can see these paintings.
Critics get fewer perks than most people think. But one of the best ones I've ever had is that I got to attend a press viewing of the marvelous new Monet show at the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. All three of its distinguished curators were there to guide us through the galleries, and best of all, we could linger afterwards. For a few minutes, I was actually all by myself in the last room of the show, with five of Monet's vast, mind-bogglingly gorgeous and apocalyptic water lily canvases. Monet called them Grand Décoration. They were his very last big project. He began during World War I and kept working on them for a decade, well into his mid-80s. One of them, unbelievably, like several other paintings in this show, has never been exhibited in public before. When I joined the crowds a week later to see them again, I was just as moved and excited, and it was fun to watch people's jaws dropping as they came into that last room. In 1900, when the show begins, Monet was 60. The show's main curator, Monet scholar Paul Hayes Tucker, says that by that time Monet was so successful he no longer had to paint for money. But he never stopped painting, except for a couple of years after the death of his wife and then of his son. When he started again, he never stopped. And as this show underlines, he never stopped experimenting. the Impressionist movement, which got its name from one of Monet's own early paintings, Impression, Sunrise, was largely about the way paint could capture and reveal light. It showed us that what we saw in the world was a lot more varied and a lot more surprising than we thought. Towards the end of his life, in the paintings he did of his garden at Giverny, with its footbridge, willows, and water lilies, it seems as if paint itself took over as the subject. It got thicker and wilder. Form itself began to dissolve. That's probably why the abstract expressionists regarded Monet as a father figure. There's an astonishing late study, nearly 7 feet square, of a willow reflected in the lily pond. That reflection consists of countless thick, fast strokes of violet and lilac. Only one small red water lily and a green lily pad in the lower right-hand corner helps us define the image. It's not just light Monet is analyzing anymore. It's reality itself. Maybe more than any other painter, Monet was obsessed by the central conflict between a flat, two-dimensional canvas and the illusion of three-dimensional depth. One room in this show lines up 24 of his small water lily paintings. All but one of them were in a major Monet exhibit in 1909. The differences between them are intriguing. Quiet blues in one become searing yellows in another. But even more fascinating is the way Monet keeps coming back to the relation between the water lilies floating on the surface and the reflections of trees and clouds in the water. It's like being in a dream, a continuous hallucination. And more. In those last huge water lily paintings, Monet is quite literally painting his image of heaven. Sublimely serene and pastel, or, in a spectacular sunset painting, agitated, practically on fire. He sees heaven by looking not up, but down, embodied in nature, on the earth, an elusive reflection on the surface of the deep water. There are no figures, no people in any of these late paintings. Yet all of this nature seems animated from within. Those willow trees with their gnarled trunks and extending branches might be Monet's self-portraits. What's also moving about these late paintings is that while so many of them are more beautiful than anything you've ever seen, sometimes even too beautiful, as in his almost touristy images of Venice, some of them are also daringly grotesque, even ugly. Monet destroyed some of his late paintings, but many he held on to without ever exhibiting them. Maybe half of the 86 paintings here were never exhibited in his lifetime, and a third of them are still in private collections. One of those five staggering water lily murals was lent by a gallery in Paris. If someone could lend me a few million dollars, I'd love to make them an offer.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Monet in the 20th Century at the Boston Museum of Fine Arts through December 27th. Fresh Air senior producer today was Roberta Schirach. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Monique Nazareth and Anne-Marie Baldonado. Alan, too, directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
For tapes or transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime, 1-888-NPR-NEWS. Also, Fresh Air interviews are now available online at www.audible.com/freshair.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Little Brown & Company, publishers of Pete Hamill's tribute to Old Blue Eyes, Why Sinatra Matters, in bookstores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.